Hello and welcome to the programme. Well, as you join me, I'm in my back garden. It's just after 8:30 p.m. And in his back garden in County Wicklow, I'm in South County Dublin, is Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland. Good evening, Niall.
Evening, Derek. How are you?
So what's the weather like there?
It's a lovely evening, I have to say. It's very calm, very quiet. On the crisp side, it's not terribly warm. It was a nice sunny day, but the sun has gone in now, so it's getting darker and it's getting cooler. But there's lots of bird song. I'm hearing lots of birds around the place, which is really nice.
And I've got a good bit of bird song here too, because my house actually backs onto the Airfield Trust. It's a private farm that was left in trust to the state by two sisters, the Overends. It's a beautiful place to visit. But at any rate, Niall, good to be talking to you this evening. Now, anybody who's been listening to Radio 1 over the last week will know that we have a special programme this evening about the Easter Bunny, given the time of year it is. We'll come to that shortly. But a lot of people talking about the fact that we had to cancel the Dawn Chorus this year. I was very upset, and our listeners are very upset, and you are very upset, Niall.
I absolutely was. It's one of the highlights of my year. I really love the Dawn Chorus programme. It's just, it's so much fun to be a part of. But also, we get so much wonderful feedback about it. It really speaks to people, and I think that there's something about birdsong that helps people really connect to nature. So, really disappointed that it can't go ahead this year, but obviously understandably so. These are difficult times in which we're living, and it's one of those necessary things that has to happen, unfortunately. I'm sure we'll be back bigger and better than ever than next year. I'm looking forward to that very much, but for this year we'll just have to enjoy the song mainly in our own gardens, I think.
Well, I hope so, because this was the fifth international Dawn Chorus, and we had more countries than ever participating this year. And it's also 25 years in May of Mooney Goes Wild. Can you believe we've been on the air for 25 years?
That's extremely impressive, all right. To have a programme dedicated to wildlife that's been going that long is something really that RT should be proud of. I think it's fantastic.
Well, I'm certainly very proud of it, very proud of Aina and Richard. You'll hear them in the programme we're broadcasting very shortly. So I want to take my hat off to Richard and Aina and Terry and Jim Wilson, everybody else who's contributed to the programme over the years. We'll talk about that in May. But I want to talk to you a little bit about birdsong right now, at this time of the evening, which is why we're pre-recording this programme. We're not meeting with each other. We're keeping a very social distance from each other. You're in your garden, as I said, and I'm in my garden. And we're some, 20 kilometres from each other.
That's right. So at this time of day, of course, it's the dusk chorus we're talking about, and as I'm speaking to you now, the light is just starting to drop and the birds are starting to gear up for that song. It's already pretty good at this stage in early April, but as April progresses, the songs will get louder and stronger, more birds will join in, and then usually by early May, the dawn chorus and the dusk chorus really peak. That's when it's really at its best. And then after that, it kind of peters off through the month of May as the birds become more preoccupied with the business of nesting, looking after their eggs and their chicks, finding food. There's less time around for the males, particularly, to be able to sing. And of course, at that stage, they've already attracted a mate. They've done a lot of their territorial defence work, so they don't really need to. Right now, in April, they're establishing those territories. So singing is a very serious business for them. And a lot of them are just sort of practicing, trying it out now. Obviously, we're going to have quite a few migrants arriving in the coming weeks, too, that are going to add to that chorus. So mainly it's just the resident birds that are singing away loudly. As I'm talking to you, there's a lovely starling on the roof of the building beside me, and it's just calling away. I don't often get to hear them here, so that's really nice. That's what it's doing. It's trying to attract a mate. It's trying to declare its patch and trying to show off how fit and strong it is, which is what birdsong is all about.
Well, in my garden at the back, I have got a blackbird, I've got some wood pigeons singing, I've got a robin off to my left, and they're all doing exactly what you were talking about. And where I'm standing right now is right beside my nest box. And if you're watching the Today Show with Maura and Dahi last Monday, you would have seen me live from the garden, and I was explaining the nest box. It's designed like a three-pointer sign that you'd see in an old country road. And one pointer is saying Mooney Goes Wild, the other says RT Radio 1, and the other one says Nest Watch 2016, because that's when we had this box erected. I had an old box, as you will remember, for about 14 years, but it was rotten, in an awful state. I had to get rid of it. And inside this box, it's designed, and I'll put a little video on the website, rte.ie/Mooney, so you can see the activity from last year. It's designed just like a thatched cottage. Got a little fireplace. It's got a picture of John Kennedy, President Kennedy, over the fireplace. It's got an old TV with the rabbit's ears, you know, the old rabbit's ears. And it's even got a door and a window. And over the door is a St. Bridget's cross to keep away the evil spirits. But the whole purpose of it was to introduce people not just to the birds, but a little bit of our own culture and looking at how people would have lived in parts of Ireland. And this is something we're hoping to take forward next year when everything is settled down, please God it will, with our partners in Europe, for each country to actually create their own nest box that resembles a traditional home in that country and have one platform where all of these webcams can be streamed from and you can have a look at them. Now, right now, my blue tits have not come back yet, Niall. I did see them prospecting in early February. I saw them going into the box and coming out, but they haven't started to nest yet. Why?
Well, they can be very fickle little creatures. And as you said, in February, that's when they often go and decide where they want to nest. They go around testing different sites. And although it'll be a few weeks or even months before they actually get down to the business of building the nest and laying the eggs, they've already fixed in their mind what the best likely locations are. So it could be, unfortunately, they found somewhere they like better. There's no accounting for taste.
No.
Yeah, there's no accounting for taste. But having said that, it's not too late. There's still lots of blue tits haven't started nesting yet. So there's every chance they still could. And when they start, it's usually quite quick. They can build those nests very rapidly, and then the eggs are laid before you know it, and then they're being incubated, then you have little chicks very quickly. So once they start, they really do it very rapidly. So I'll keep my fingers crossed for you.
Oh, I'm keeping my fingers and my toes crossed. It's only the female that builds the nest, though, in the blue tit family.
That's right, yes. So with different species behave in different ways. So with some birds, like the robin, for example, both sexes play a part in doing that. But with the blue tit, like with many other birds, the female builds the nest there. The male is still a good parent. He does some of the incubation work, of course, and he brings lots of food to his mate and to the chicks. So that happens there. Contrast that to birds like most duck species, for example, like the mallards or the tufted ducks that might be in your local park. In those species, what happens is the female does 100% of the work and the male does absolutely nothing whatsoever. His sole job is
something.
Just to, well, one thing, it's very, very, very quick and soon forgotten about. It's his job to mate with the female, and that is his entire contribution to the whole process. She lays the eggs by herself, builds the nest herself, of course, then looks after the chicks once they hatch out all by herself, and the male does absolutely nothing further.
Is there any situation in nature where the male takes over the incubation completely?
There are a few cases, yes. There are a few exceptions that prove the rule. In Ireland, we have one example particularly. It's a very rare bird called the red-necked phalarope. It's a member of the wader family, but it's one of the most colourful waders in the world. They're absolutely tiny, but they're a lovely red patch on the neck, a big long pointed beak, and they're really small, barely bigger than a sparrow, but with big long legs and beak. And in that species, what happens is that it's the female who's the really colourful one. She does the singing, she does the territorial displays and threatens the other females. She attracts in a male. The male then mates with her and she lays the eggs. And as soon as she's laid the eggs, she then scarpers and leaves him to do all the incubation and all the rearing of the chicks. She never sees her own chicks. In fact, what research has shown is that the ones that breed in Ireland, which now only breed in quite remote parts of the Mullet Peninsula in Mayo, and that kind of area, some of it on Bird Watch Ireland Reserve, actually. What happens then is the female does that, lays the eggs, and then she actually leaves and goes further north, perhaps to somewhere like Iceland or Scotland, and entices another male and sort of talks him into looking after the eggs. So she just leaves Ireland entirely and has these little families all over the place. So it's a very interesting strategy. There's another bird called the dotterel, which does the same thing. It doesn't breed here in Ireland, although we occasionally get them on migration, and there is a small population breeding in Scotland. And they have this role reversal as well, where the female is the colourful one, she's the dominant one, she displays and sings and marks the territory, and the male does all the child rearing and incubating. But in the natural world, it's very rare. It's usually either just the female alone or a 50-50 split between the parents.
Actually, I want to go back to my blue tits. I don't want to be too unkind to the male, because I know the female, when she lays the eggs, and she lays one each day until the full clutch is laid, and that can be anything up to 16 eggs, depending on how productive she is in that year and how much food she gets. But she then starts incubating when the last egg is laid. But he does feed her during that period, doesn't he?
He does. He's very attentive. And it's lovely when you especially see it on a nest camera, because there's a hidden world to these birds' lives that we're only able to see in the last few years. You'll see the female particularly turning over the eggs, making sure that they all get evenly incubated. And all the time the male is coming and giving her food. And he's also keeping watch for danger. So sometimes you can hear him somewhere else in the garden keeping a watch out for maybe a cat or a squirrel or something like that that might pose a threat. And he's giving these little cheeps, these little high-pitched calls that you barely notice, but they're signals to the female to keep a low profile, keep the head down. Don't make any noise at the moment. And when the chicks hatch out too, sometimes they'll respond to that as well. They'll be told basically by their parents to shut up, and they will. So it's quite interesting to see that, because obviously chicks in the nest, they're competing with each other for food. There's all this cheeping and hollering, wanting the parents to feed them, which can be dangerous. So some species, the birds have learned to be quiet when their parents tell them to. So I'm sure there's a few parents at home at the moment who wish they had similar skills. It's interesting with blue tits as well, because although to our eyes the male and the female look exactly the same pretty much, to each other they look very different. Male blue tits have a big patch of ultraviolet coloration on the backs of their heads, which the females lack. Now, we humans, our eyes are not capable of seeing ultraviolet. It's a completely invisible part of the spectrum to us. But to birds, it's a colour just like any other, just like red, green or blue. We just can't even conceive of what it must look like. So it's a mystery colour. And in the same way that, let's say, blue and yellow would mix together to make green, so blue and ultraviolet must mix together to make yet another colour that we can't even imagine. So blue tits probably look quite different to the way we actually expect if you look at them through another blue tit's eyes.
That's how predators find their prey on the ground, because they trace the urine. They can see the ultraviolet urine trace, can't they? Isn't that true?
That's right. That's what kestrels do, particularly. Birds of prey, like many other birds, can see ultraviolet, but no mammal can see that at all. So the thing is that mouse and vole urine, it actually does, yes, reflect ultraviolet light. One of the unpleasant things about mice, especially if you happen to have them in your house, is that mice have no control over their sphincter muscles. So they just leak a little trail of urine everywhere they go. And they're not aware that this is actually reflecting ultraviolet light that they can't see, that we humans mm-hmm. can't see, but a bird like a kestrel can see like a beacon. So they're able to follow these trails through the vegetation to the undergrowth and see exactly where the trail stops, there must be a mouse. And that's how they find them.
And then back to the blue tits, something similar but different. The blue tits, you will see, they will actually take away the fecal sacs from the young in the nest. Yes. When they feed them, when they come in to feed the nestlings, you'll see a nestling just turn upside down and this little white sac come out of its bottom. And then one of the adults will take it away and fly as far away from the nest as it possibly can, sometimes dropping it in a river so it flows downstream. So there's no evidence of there being any bird around, no waste at all for any predator to pick up on.
That's absolutely right. And it's amazing, these little packets, these fecal sac, they're contained in a little membrane, so that it's not even a messy experience. The parent bird just takes this little sac, it doesn't break, and they take it and then, as you said, they drop it away from the nest. And the idea for that, behind that, is first of all, they don't want to foul the nest, because obviously having droppings in the nest could lead to bacteria and flies and all sorts of other unpleasant things that they don't want. But more importantly, if there were droppings around the nest, it would be a sure sign to an observant predator that there were young chicks in that nest, and it would be very dangerous for them. So that's the strategy that the blue tits, like many other Irish birds have, is to make sure the nest is kept as clean as possible. Now, there are some birds that take completely the opposite strategy, and a good example of that is a bird called the hoopoe, which doesn't breed in Ireland, although most years we get a few of them, particularly on the south coast, when they overshoot France on migration. It's a very colourful bird. It looks like half bird, half butterfly. It's got these big black and white zebra patterned wings, sort of pink body with a big flamboyant pink crest on its head. It's a remarkable looking bird. And so they look very beautiful to us, but they're actually one of the stinkiest birds around. They smell terrible. And their strategy at the nest is to make the nest smell so bad that no predator wants to go anywhere near it. So imagine how bad something would have to be that something like a fox wouldn't want to eat there. That's how bad they are. So there's two different strategies there. Keep it really clean or keep it really dirty.
Thank you very much indeed. And I just want to remind people, we were talking at the beginning of this programme about the Dawn Chorus and the Dusk Chorus and the International Dawn Chorus being cancelled in May. But we have made available to you on our website, rte.ie/Mooney, 1 hour uninterrupted birdsong, which I recorded last May, on the 3rd of May, at Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve. Usually before the Dawn Course, which was on the 4th of May last year, I'll go into the site where we're broadcasting from the main outside broadcast site, and I'll have a listen to where the birds are, and when the OB guys come down, I'll say, there's a bird over there, a bird over there, a bird over there. There's a robin, there's a blackbird, you've got a sedge warbler over there, and you've got some mallard on the lake over there. So that is now available, never been broadcast before. Go to rte.ie/Mooney. A simple stereo recording, so if you were standing where I had placed the two microphones crisscrossed, you would be hearing what they're hearing. So it's a very real feeling. It's not like we normally give you with the 24 or 34 microphones and then 34 locations around the world. But it'll give you a good idea of what a dawn chorus is like if you were standing in the middle of the woodland. You've heard it, Niall, haven't you?
Yeah, it's really lovely. And as you said, it really is like being there, because, as you said, on the Dawn Chorus programme, it's a blending of many microphones from many different sites. But this is a pure recording in a way. It shows you exactly what it's like to be right where the birds are and to hear it through their ears, because birds hear it in very much the same frequency range that we do. Mammals like cats and dogs, they hear at a higher pitch than we do, but birds is more or less the same, which is why birdsong sounds so good to us and why it's so easily picked up by microphones that are designed for human voices as well. And it's a really lovely recording. It really, really evocative, really puts us in the mood. I'll certainly be listening to it, maybe with a bit of a tear in my eye that we're not doing it for real this year, but I'm looking forward to next year already.
Well, listen, we'll talk again next week, because I want to talk to you about the energy birds require to actually sing at dusk and at dawn, and we welcome welcome your emails, mooney@rte.ie. But please do, don't miss out on nature. As I was saying to Maura and Dahi during the week, if you want to enjoy the dawn chorus or birdsong or nature, pull up a chair in your favourite room and open the window first thing in the morning and at dusk around this time, and you'll get that full spectrum of nature which is out there. Or just visit the website rte.ie/mooney and download the Dawn Chorus broadcast. It's very easy to find. You'll find it on our homepage, and you can listen to that wherever you want, anytime, anywhere, at your leisure. Now, today is Easter Monday, and we've got a very special programme, first broadcast in April 2006, about the Easter Bunny, presented by Dr. Richard Collins.
Well, I suppose Easter is called Easter after the Anglo-Saxon goddess Oestre, who had as one of her friends the hare. And I suppose in more recent times, this has been supplanted with the rabbit, really. But Easter was a time, and still is, it's springtime. And springtime is when all nature is coming to life. The birds are mating, eggs are being laid, lambs are being had, all of this. So the one thing you really want at this time of the year is fertility. And so the symbols of fertility always were eggs, hares and rabbits. Hares and rabbits being symbols of good luck and fertility, and the egg, of course, being sort of the encapsulation of life.
Rabbits are flavour of the month just now, but the original Easter Bunny wasn't a rabbit, but a hare. Amorous Mad March hares pester females in the spring. A lady hare, however, won't accept the advances of every old Tom, Dick and Harry, and if she doesn't fancy a would-be suitor, she stands on her hind legs and beats him off. These boxing matches are conspicuous in spring when the grass is short, and so the hare became the Easter Bunny. But rabbits are cuddlier than hares and a bigger hit with the public. In a bloodless coup d'etat, they ousted the hare to become the Easter goddess Oestre's favourite animal.
In the days of the Celts, when these things all began, we didn't actually have rabbits in this part of the world. They would have been hares, and they would be more difficult to get hold of, I suppose. You'd know the hare, you'd know it was a sign of good luck to see one. You'd know that these were very fertile creatures, many 4 or 5 litters a year, maybe with 3 or 4 young in each. So you could end up with 140 babies in a year. Fair fertility there, all right, if they all survived. And the eggs then, of course, being originally, I suppose, depending on the sun. The sun was a big roundy thing that all the light and the fertility depended upon, and the egg then was sort of a manifestation of that. And they used to roll the eggs down the hill. They used to get up on Easter morning and observe the sun, and the sun always dances on Easter morning. Now, you wouldn't look at the sun, you'd go blind. So what they did was they looked into wells and they saw the sun dancing in the well, because the water was dancing. So obviously it did dance if you looked at it in a well. And in fact, this day, some of these wells in Ireland are called Sunday's wells, Sunday wells, Sunday wells, holy wells, that you went to see the sun dancing on Easter morning. And dance it did if you looked at it through a well. And then the eggs, then you'd roll them down the hill. This would be a symbol of the sun rising in the heavens. And of course, when Christianity took over Easter, they gave these things new interpretations. So rolling the eggs was the equivalent of the big stone at the sepulchre rolling back so that Christ could rise up. This was commemorating the rolling back of the stone. It really was an earlier and pagan custom, but fair dues to the early Christians. They didn't abolish anyone's customs. They just gave them new meanings. And of course, with Lent then, and you couldn't eat anything of nice during Lent, you'd have loads of eggs left over by Easter time, and you'd have to be eating them, hiding them, getting rid of them and putting them out for people to find. So this custom of going out to hunt and look for eggs would have happened because there would have been a plentiful supply of eggs at that time, and you might have had them for a week or two. They mightn't be the freshest. So to put, hard-boil them, put them out, hide them, this would all be part of this adoration, if you like, of this symbol of fertility that the egg was. So really, then when chocolate came in the 19th century, well, you'd give somebody a gift of eggs, you'd give them a gift of a chocolate egg, that would be even nicer. And the Easter Bunny then got rehabilitated as the fellow who brought the eggs. And, you know, this thing has gotten to the stage now where you have, I see them in the shops, Easter bunnies carrying baskets with eggs in them. So, I mean, this is a real mixture at the end of the day of real genuine traditions that went way back to the dawn of history. So it's amazing, really, that we don't really think when you're out buying the old Cadbury's egg that you're actually celebrating something that might be 5,000 or 6,000 years old. Amazing.
As Ian and Ilana intimated, the rabbit usurpers have no claim to the throne. They're not even natives.
You can find your way into the chaos.
very impressive.
And follow with the bones.
My God, there's an archive of information and
rubbish, some would call it. Here,
Hares came here over a land bridge at the end of the Ice Age, but rabbits are Johnny-come-latelys, brought in by other blow-ins, the Romans and the Normans. Dr. Tom Hayden of University College Dublin is co-author of Exploring Irish Mammals, the standard work on our furry friends.
Well, obviously the nearest relatives to the rabbits are hares, as you suggested, but beyond that, the nearest relatives are now, we are pretty certain, rodents. And this was the belief perhaps 100 years ago. Then it was thought that, well, perhaps they weren't, and the taxonomy has shifted backwards and forwards and people have made their careers arguing about it. But the DNA data now is suggesting that the nearest relative to rabbits and hares are in fact rodents after all.
Oh, very good. Well, now, to the beginning, let's clarify what we mean by a rabbit and what we mean by a hare. How would you tell a rabbit from a hare if you ran into one?
Well, it's largely a difference of size, behaviour and general biology. Rabbits tend to be smaller than hares in general, but they almost grate into one another. In some cases, in the public mind, there's some confusion, not necessarily in Ireland, but what is a rabbit and what is a hare. But in general, hares in general are open plains kind of runners. I mean, it's no surprise, unfortunate for the hare, of course, but they are used for coursing. Rabbits are not, because hares can tend to run for long distances and at relatively high speeds, and they've got a lot of stamina. And if you ever were to eat hare stew or jugged hare, the meat of hare is very dark because their muscles are full of mitochondria and myoglobin and all the things that deliver large amounts of oxygen. And that's why they can run for such a long time and relatively fast. So they're like marathon runners in a sense, by comparison to rabbit, whose meat is very pale. And it looks a bit like chicken. People say it looks like chicken or tastes like chicken. This is because it doesn't have many mitochondria. It doesn't have much myoglobin, which was what... This is a protein like hemoglobin, so it doesn't circulate in our blood and it makes our muscles look dark. And so these animals tend to be sprinters. And that's why you never see a rabbit far from cover. Mm. And in principle, if you get a rabbit in the open and chase after him, you should be able to wear him down and exhaust him and catch him. This is what the biochemical theory would tell you. Now, I have suffered many times with pet rabbits who escaped, chasing them around neighbours' gardens, and I never succeeded in exhausting them. I just ended up looking stupid.
That might have more to do with your spare tire than anything else.
Well, there is that too, but it was less spare then than it is now.
Well, now, the bunny, our bunny, our particular kind of rabbit, he started life in Spain, didn't he?
As far as we know, yes, southern Europe, North Africa, but probably southern Europe, Spain most likely.
And he lived there presumably for countless times, millennia, and unchanged. And what happened next?
Well, I mean, they're still in Spain, of course. Mm-hmm. Or some of them are still in Spain, although their numbers are diminished rapidly, which we may return to later on. But so it's still in Spain. It's still the centre of the distribution. Part of their spread was primarily due to the action of humans, mm-hmm. Because they were domesticated relatively early on. By the Romans particularly, who brought it to a fine art. And they moved them around quite a bit.
So the Romans came in and their legionaries loved their rabbit stew, and maybe even the odd centurion would eat the rabbit stew. And of course the skins became all the rage on the Roman catwalks with the ladies walking up and down in ancient Roman times. So the rabbits became flavour of the month, really, didn't they? Literally, as well as everything else. So how did the Romans do this, and what did they do to the rabbits?
Well, as far as we know, they tend to confine them in enclosures. And I mean, it's the stock approach to trying to get more animals, make them breed faster and make them not die so young. So if you can control the mortality and increase the reproduction, then you're away. Assuming, of course, the animals will take to this kind of lifestyle. Rabbits were domesticated, hares weren't. Mm-hmm. You know, partly due to their biology. I mean, there have been hares in captivity, but you can't breed them in the same way that you can breed rabbits.
Are you saying then that breeding like rabbits, having lots of babies and having them very often, is the result of Roman meddling, that Romans induced the rabbits to do this, and the rabbits we have now are all kind of artificial rabbits created by Romans? Is that right?
Well, you could argue that. It's hard to say. I mean, this is one of these questions you like asking that are impossible to answer, but it's probably true. I mean, most domestic animals are quite unusual because they've been selected for things that we want. I mean, most domestic animals are more docile than wild animals, for example. And animals that we tend to domesticate tend to be quite tolerant of high population densities. I mean, it's not surprising that sheep, you know, cattle, goats, all live in herds. You know, I mean, if they were solitary, they would never work because they'd be fighting all the time. So you want animals that will live in large groups to start with and have a high breeding rate if possible. And if it isn't high, you'd try and improve it as best you can. And so there is a possibility that their high reproductive rate is probably partly due to the influence of humans, because rabbits in their natural range now are not very common, partly because of diseases.
That's an interesting thing. They've stayed in Spain now. I mean, they thrive everywhere from Ireland to Australia, where we introduced them, and they become a pest. And yet, of their own accord, they'd never got to Italy, which is just over the way, and looks to somebody like me perfect for rabbit territory. How could that come about?
Well, it may have something to do with barriers in the way. It may have something to do with predation. I'm not entirely sure. I don't know, to be honest, why they're relatively restricted, and that most of the distributions now are artificial. But it's certainly true that, given them the kind of habitats they like, they will work really well. And here, for example, they may produce many litters in a year. Although in Spain, I understand where they come from, they will only breed twice a year because the summer is too dry. They need green vegetation.
I'm reading a lot into the very limited history here. I don't know for certain if Legionnaires ever ate stew, but somebody was eating it back then.
Well, you seem so convincing, I'm prepared to believe you.
But so Caesar took it into Gaul, so you have rabbits all over France. But it didn't get here, though, until quite modern times, relatively modern times. How did it get to Ireland?
Well, it came to us in about 1200 or thereabouts with the Normans. And the earliest documentary evidence that I'm aware of from Norman times in these islands is on Lambay Island, which was about 1210 or 11 or something, as far as I can remember. And there were several other ones around the place at the same time. Many islands, in fact, because, of course, they're easy to confine, they're easier to manage.
And you can poachers don't get them so easy.
Well, there's also that, I suppose,
have
yeah.
to go on a boat to
that's
get a few course, rabbits yeah. and they'd be spotted going out there anyway.
That's true, yeah.
So I suppose Warren's an ideal place to put these, yeah. and they're still on places like Skookum and the Salties and all these places still have rabbits today. Yeah. Presumably as a result.
Absolutely. I mean, there are loads of them on Dalkey Island even at the minute. Mm.
So on the mainland then, if you were Strongbow and his henchmen, they're setting up their Mott and Bailey forts and then their big castles. Presumably they constructed rabbit warrens as well, places where they could have these rabbits and eat them and take the skins and so on. And what would these warrens, these artificial warrens, look like, or what the technology involved in those would have been?
Well, they were essentially a big wall with a ditch, which sometimes had water, sometimes didn't. As strange as it may seem, the only ones that exist in any way that we can reconstruct what they look like are from England. There don't seem to be many here that I know of. I don't know of any archaeological excavation of a rabbit warren here. And there must have been hundreds and hundreds of them, because one of the most common place names to do with animals in Ireland is to do with rabbits, which is very strange to me, considering it arrived so late.
Warren Point, for instance.
Yes, but mostly to the Irish name, which is actually more interesting, which meant it got into the Irish language very quickly. Because the Irish is cunning, as you know, and that's a corruption of coney, which is what a rabbit was known as when they arrived here. Mm-hmm. The word rabbit referred originally to a baby rabbit, well, what we call a baby rabbit now, or a baby coney, I should say, was a rabbit.
And the coney was the daddy, was it?
The coney was the adult, instead of a general name for the adults. And all over the country, there's hardly a county in Ireland that has several place names, which are something like Conigar, or Conigar, or Conicare, or Conigare, or some version, or even Nicker, in its corrupt, sort of contracted state. And they all refer to Coney Earth, which is what they would have been called in English, or Coney Garth, and then it got shortened to Conigare. In fact, there's a place called Coney Burrow, actually, between Leixlip and Selbridge, where the old bridge crosses the Liffey at the reservoir, in fact, which was a site of one, I guess, but I have no idea if there's any trace of it there.
Richard Adams' novel Watership Down was published in 1973. Adams, an obscure civil servant in Britain's Department of the Environment, wrote this children's book in his spare time. Its heroes are a group of rabbits, rendered homeless when their warren faces destruction to make way for a new housing estate. The tale, a metaphor for growing up and venturing out into a dangerous world, was an instant success and soon became a classic. In 1985, Penguin Books declared that they'd sold more copies of Watership Down than of any other novel, with the exception of George Orwell's Animal Farm. Is it a kind of dream? Floating out on the tide, following the river of death downstream. Oh, is it a dream? There's a fog. Adams knew little about rabbits when he began his writing. Then he came across R.M. Lockley's book, The Private Life of the Rabbit, and he reworked the narrative to take account of real-life rabbit behaviour. In 1927, Lockley had gone to live in Skokholm, off the Welsh coast. He was primarily a birdman, but he soon began studying the rabbits, which were his constant companions on the island.
Bright eyes.
Dr. Madeline Havard is Chief Executive of the Wildlife Trust of South and West Wales, which manages Skokholm for its seabird colonies. She told me about the special relationship between the rabbits and the birds on the island.
They're different on islands. They tend to live out in the open on the islands because there's far fewer predators. There's no ground predators like foxes and so on. So
the great black-backed gulls and perhaps even herring gulls would. Well,
you do see quite a lot of rabbit bodies, I'm afraid, and these great black-backs are very adept at swallowing rabbits.
They turn the skin inside out.
Yes,
what do you mean they turn the skin inside out?
You always know a great black-backed gull kill of a rabbit because it eats the rabbit, but the skin is very neatly turned inside out. You know, the fur is inside and the inside skin. And it's beautifully neat, very tidy.
A little package, yes.
How do they do it? It's amazing, but that's what they do.
Similarly with the Manx shearwaters, which are the very important birds that we've got, ground nesting birds on the island, and you look at these remains, you think, oh, what has done that? And it's the gulls managed to turn them inside out.
Now, you mentioned the Manx shearwater. Now, I'm tempted to think that the rabbit was of great benefit to the Manx shearwater because the rabbit, of course, creates accommodation. He's a landlord, you know. He digs holes and he lets them out to shearwaters and to puffins. Or is that true? And would there be such an enormous population? You have a huge population of Manx shearwaters in Skomer and Skokholm, the biggest of the world when you combine the two.
That's right, yeah.
And are they there because of the rabbit in any sense?
I'm sure that it's a big advantage. I mean, it's a hard life for a bird to have to excavate a burrow, whereas if a rabbit's done that for you, you just have to tidy it up a bit. And there's some fascinating letters from the 1900s that Beatrix Potter sent back to a young girl after she'd visited. She was on holiday in Tenby. She visited, we think, Skokholm, because the drawings has a lighthouse, so it's there. And she said that she witnessed squabbles between rabbits and puffins as one would go into the burrow and the other one would try and chuck it out. And so you think, oh, well, perhaps Peter Rabbit is associated here as well, you know, because she was watching then and drawing pictures. Yeah, the two islands, Skomer and Skokholm, are really, really riddled with burrows. There's about 45,000 pairs of Manx shearwaters just on Skokholm. There's, as you say, just about 40%, between 40 and 45% of the world's population between the two islands. So it's really, really important. But the storm petrels, they are nesting in stony burrows, in walls and so on. And then the puffins also using the rabbit burrows. It's a very, very interesting mix. And because we don't have any predators there, we don't have rats, we don't have cats, we're very lucky to have this dense population of the birds and the rabbits as well.
I've seen it suggested that another bird that benefits from rabbits is the chough, because apparently the rabbit, of course, keeps the grass down and keeps the vegetation, it's, you know, tight haircut, short back and sides kind of an approach to things. And this helps the chough because he can get at the little insects and invertebrates that he needs that way. But I must say, looking at the two atlases that were produced, one in 68, 72 and one 20 years later, whatever it was,
which atlases are you talking
the
about?
The British Trust for Ornithology, IWC Atlas of Breeding Birds.
Breeding
there were
birds.
Two, one 1968, 72, the other was 1988 and 92 was it, 91. Now, the interesting thing about that is that the chough was there according to the first atlas in your islands, but was absent according to the second atlas. So have they come back? That's the first question. And are the rabbits not doing their work or something?
They have come back. We're delighted to have a good population now. There's breeding pairs on both Skomer and Skokholm. One breeding pair successfully fledged three on Skokholm last year. And there's four breeding pairs on Skomer. It's about 10% of the Pembrokeshire population of chough. And all whole of Pembrokeshire has seen an increase. So these birds are coming back now, but you're absolutely right. It's the management of the land that's so important. And of course, the rabbits are our only vegetation managers, apart from the wardens, who do their work as well. But we've lost the agricultural aspect of the island. We haven't got sheep. There were a few cattle over there at one stage as well, and even a horse. But we haven't got those big herbivores anymore, the big grazers. So the rabbits are the only ones who are keeping that maritime turf there. And of course, the island is important for the maritime vegetation as well. So they're very, very important for the whole of the island ecosystem.
So you're studying the rabbits equally now, are you, to the shearwaters?
Well, we do counts every year, of course, and it's very interesting. Like many small mammals, the populations, you know, really oscillate. And some years you have really good populations, and other years they seem to crash. We haven't got myxomatosis out there, but we have got the viral hemorrhagic disease. So,
the new one.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So they do go through these cycles, as a lot of small mammals do.
In 53, did you have myxomatosis out there, or did it escape completely?
I think we missed it out entirely of that island, but we have had it on the other islands. So it's all dependent whether there were rabbiters out there with taking ferrets, wasn't it? Basically, it's the rabbit flea, of course, that is the vector for this.
Madeline mentioned myxomatosis and the great catastrophe which struck rabbits worldwide during the 1950s. Veterinary surgeon Andrew Byrne.
Well, myxomatosis was introduced, if you like. It was a naturally occurring disease in certain parts of the world. But rabbits, as well as being efficient digesters, unfortunately, they're also very efficient reproducers. And this is a problem which really came to its fore in this century. And with changes in agricultural practice, rabbits had an abundance of food material. And they bred and bred. A rabbit can produce 4 or 5 litters in a breeding season, and each of them have about 4 to 6 rabbit kittens. And the problem first came to light in Australia, where they were overrun with rabbits. And the agriculture industry were very concerned about this, and they wanted to find a way of reducing the numbers. In fact, this idea first was thought about in the early part of the century, around about 1918, 1919. And a Brazilian scientist first came up with the idea of using a myxoma virus to infect rabbits and reduce the population. And a little bit of research was done in the early part of the century, and the Australians initially looked at it and said it probably wouldn't work. But they did a few trials and they found it did seem to work. And then in 1950, they introduced it into Australia with devastating effects, or very successful effects, depending on what your opinion of this is. Because within 6 months of introducing the virus, they had reduced the rabbit population by around about 80 to 90%. The disease itself, it's one of these viral diseases that requires what we call a vector to transmit it. And in Australia, originally, the vector that was transmitting it was the mosquito. And they found, therefore, it was killing rabbits in the non-arid areas where the mosquito would live. But across the dry areas, the mosquito couldn't breed because mosquitoes need damp areas and pools of water to reproduce. So they then, after a few years, introduced the European rabbit flea to Australia, which is the vector for myxomatosis in this part of the world. And so in the slightly drier areas, in the rabbit flea transmitted the virus from rabbit to rabbit. And again, then that brought mortality rates back up again. It was quite a big operation. The disease did originally occur in rabbits in South America and Uruguay, and I think in Afghanistan, I believe, as well. But those rabbit populations had some immunity against it. But now you're introducing a virus into the same species, but in an area where they had no natural immunity. And that's why it was so devastating. And then, of course, it was introduced into Europe then later on. It was introduced into France in 1953. I think it was 1950 it first came into Australia. And it appeared mysteriously in England about 1954. And it's one of the great mysteries as to whether or not it actually was introduced accidentally or on purpose. But it appeared in the UK in the mid-1950s. And again, with devastating effects. And some estimates say that it initially reduced the rabbit population by about 99%. But it is really truly a horrific disease. I mean, while there might have been a need to cull rabbits, it is quite a nasty infection. It causes very severe symptoms, and it takes about 2 weeks for the animals to die. Initially, it affects the rabbit a little bit like flu. They get a temperature, they're a little bit off their food, then they recover for a few days. And then by about day 7, they start to get eye discharge and conjunctivitis. And they get lots of pussy discharge from the eyes and the nose. And then it affects the genital system and then the urinary tract system and the skin. And eventually they die by about 14 days. And there's no effective treatment for it.
Myxomatosis was one of the reasons why people in Ireland stopped eating rabbits during the 1950s, as broadcaster and chef Eamon O'Cahoyne recalls.
I remember being fascinated by the notion of rabbit and of eating rabbit, I presume from books that I would read and also British comics such as The Dandy and the Beano. There'd always be poachers having rabbit stew, you know, at the end of the day. And I was always fascinated with food. So I remember distinctly asking my father, maybe at the age of 9 or 10, look, what about rabbit? And he turned his nose up and said, I wouldn't eat rabbit. And I said, why ever not? And he said, myxomatosis. So that was a new word for me, and I was introduced to that. And of course, that is part and parcel of the Irish psyche and the Irish attitude towards eating rabbit. And a young girl just said it to me about 10 minutes ago when I was asking her, she wouldn't eat rabbit for that very reason. And I mean, this was way back in the mid 50s, and it's an incredible indictment of our conservative attitude to food that 50 years on we're still not prepared to eat something that suffered from a disease, a man-induced disease as well, to keep numbers down, way back in the mid 50s. And I find that very sad, because I've since come to eat rabbit and appreciate rabbit, and I love it. Now, I remember when I was running a restaurant here in Dublin in the 1980s and early 90s that I used to serve rabbit, but I quickly learned that I couldn't serve it as a main course. Irish people just wouldn't have it. That is not to say that they were unadventurous. They would try it as a starter. The starter level of a meal was where Irish people like to try new things, but they seem to feel that they might be shortchanged if they had it as a main course, or they might not get value for money, or the worst thing of all, that they might go home hungry. So that if you put it on as a main course, it simply wouldn't sell. But put it on in any kind of fashion as a starter, say maybe with polenta, which was coming into vogue at the time, or a traditional rabbit stew, or say this modern fashion of doing it with honey and chili, glazed with honey and chili, and it would fly out the door. It was amazing. But main course level, no, there was still this, I will not eat rabbit.
Better close this, might be cattle in the field. Well, Damien, this is your territory for buzzards, is it?
Yeah, this is one of my buzzard sites. They're nesting just over here, crossing this hillside over here.
Yeah, there's a nice little stand of mixed woodland over there. Lots of ivy on the trees. Do they like that? They do.
Yeah, it's good cover for the nests. Keeps them protected, you know, from predators, things like that.
People may be squeamish about eating rabbits, but not so birds of prey. Damien Clark, wildlife ranger with the Wicklow Mountains National Park, is studying the breeding ecology of the buzzard in Ireland. Damien, the buzzard is, of course, Ireland's largest hawk, and we didn't have buzzards much in this part of the country until fairly recently, and they've come back. They are intimately connected with rabbits. Is their demise in the past and their recovery anything to do with the rabbit population?
Yeah, it's certainly linked to this. Productivity of buzzards is strongly linked to its prey availability. And in Britain and Ireland, rabbits is one of the main items. So when there was crashes in the rabbit population due to myxomatosis, the buzzards take a big hit.
So in the old days, long ago here, there would have been loads of rabbits and we had a good population of buzzards.
Certainly, yeah.
So up to, when was it, in the 50s, the myxomatosis thing broke out. Did the buzzards collapse then with the rabbits?
No, they'd actually gone before that. It was sort of the turn of the 19th century, buzzards were gone. And in the 50s, they were slowly coming back. But with the myxomatosis crash, it was a very slow spread at that time.
So has the recovery of rabbits, they haven't really recovered, but there's a lot more of them now than there were, say, a decade or two ago. Has that helped the buzzards
come
back?
Yeah, I think it's certainly linked to it, yeah.
And to what extent do you find rabbit in their prey?
Different nests vary, different pairs specialise in different things, but this site here, rabbit was the main prey item. I go to the nests to check what they're feeding on. I climb the nest and see what's in it, and on one of my visits here, this nest had 30 rabbit carcasses in it in one go.
My God.
Yeah.
It struck me, though, Damien, that if I were a buzzard, I wouldn't be able to catch rabbits. Buzzards are big, slow birds. They're quite conspicuous because they're quite dark against the sky. A rabbit should spot a buzzard coming. How does it catch rabbits?
Well, I suppose they miss a lot. They just have to try a lot. But they're getting juvenile rabbits is what I'm finding. So I suppose the young rabbits, are a little more foolish than the adults. But also the way they'd hunt, they'd swoop over hedges and try to surprise the rabbits. They could see them from quite far away, so they can try ambush them, things like that.
When a buzzard arrives on the scene, the rabbit disappears underground. If rabbits were domesticated by the Romans, could they be responsible for the rabbit's tendency to dig warrens? A question I put to Dr. Madeleine Havert.
I mean, it's a fascinating thought, because certainly on the islands there are purpose-built warrens. You know, they were actually built with hummocks and so on. Not ones that we've identified particularly on Skokholm, but on some of the other islands there are. So you thought, well, there was purpose behind this. They must have had to build shelter, you know, to protect the rabbits. And the fact that they have adopted this lifestyle now might well be the environmental circumstance as well as the breeding.
Whether rabbits learned to construct warrens from the Romans or vice versa, the building of artificial warrens continues today in Spain, as Dr. Tom Hayden explains.
In Spain, there are hardly any rabbits left, and there's been a serious problem with myxomatosis to start with and rabbit hemorrhagic disease. We took our students out on a field trip to the Doñana National Park, which happens to be a centre for rabbit breeding, which is much to the consternation and amusement of the Australian students who can't understand when they spent £250,000 building an area for breeding rabbits to release, when this seems completely illogical to them. But the interesting point is the rabbit became a really critical key species in southern Spain, which one mightn't have expected, because during the Ice Age, when Spain was tended to be cut off from the rest of Europe, the lynx population in Spain was also, of course, isolated from the rest of Europe. And so were the imperial eagles also. And in those populations, they became very rapidly rabbit specialists. And when the ice retreated, these animals are now almost totally dependent on rabbits. And when the rabbit population crashed, as it did, first of all, myxomatosis and then rabbit hemorrhagic disease, the lynx and the imperial eagle are in serious trouble. And, of course, there were habitat changes as well. But the problem now is the food supply. And there's a huge effort trying to breed rabbits to release them. And they are being released into artificial warrens. They are building big mounds with tree roots and things to provide, you know, almost ready-made tunnels. And they're releasing the animals on a regular program now to try and get the food supply back. And the lynx are responding. I mean, there are very few lynx left. We're talking less than a couple of hundred. And they have about 15 or so in captivity for a captive breeding program. And while we were there, was great excitement. Two were born. So, you know, we were... with much excitement. Hardly a dry eye in the house. We watched it on closed-circuit television.
Marvellous. Europe's rarest cat.
Well, it is, yeah.
Could you take me into a warren? Is it like, say, a block of flats where everyone has their own door? You go along the corridor outside and you pop into your own little niche? Or is it like an open-plan office where there's meeting rooms and latrines and open areas and little territories? What sort of a society exists inside in a warren?
Is this one question?
Well, try. Have a go at it. Stick your neck out.
Well, there are essentially a tunnel system with the chambers associated with them, with a number of openings. And so there may be one or two openings, or maybe five or six openings, into a set of interconnecting tunnels. And the only way to find out is to either to excavate one, mm-hmm, or stick a ferret in one and see where it comes out. And if it goes in one hole, it comes out the other. They're obviously connected. And this is the way a lot of it has been done. Mm-hmm. So there may often be five or six openings. And so rabbits dig burrows, which is sort of a single entrance, single chamber, short tunnel kind of thing. And females tend to use these kind of things when they're breeding. They often have their young in what they call nest stops, or these sort of separate little burrows. But the warren system has a number of openings, and it's often occupied by variable number of rabbits. It might be 20 or 30 or 40, an assortment of males and females, which have hierarchical systems between them. So there's a hierarchy among the males and the females. The most dominant males, we think, mate with probably most of the females. The females tend to compete for nest sites. So in a warren, I suppose the biggest resource is the appropriate nest site, which the females compete for, and the males compete for the females. And there is a sort of communal defence as far as we can work out. So the males do a lot of territorial marking, and some of the little piles of droppings you see around in what look like well-worn areas are places the males visit regularly. It's not that they're clean in their habits. I'm not saying that they're not clean in their habits, but these sort of piles of latrines are significant social areas where they urinate and deposit feces, and also mark with scent glands under their chins to indicate where the boundaries are. So there's a certain amount of territorial squabbling goes on. In a warren, you may have a number of these bigger social groups kind of cheek by jowl, but relatively separate from one another.
So the picture you paint is of kind of coalitions. It's like a great big suburban housing estate in which there's a kind of a wife-swapping club of several males who come, sort of associate together, and their wives are in another pool. And another coalition down at the far end of the estate of another such dubious club. So when you say they're defending territories, are the males working together, five or six of them, to defend a communal territory in which they have a series of loose-living females of whom they could fraternize? Or is it a case of me defending my little 2x4 panel, whatever it is, and keeping everybody at bay?
Yeah, I guess that's about it, yes.
Is that what it is?
More or less.
Coalitions fighting with each other.
Coalition is perhaps a strong word. I mean, there seems to be some element of communal defence of the territories. Whether it's enlightened self-interest on behalf of the defenders or whether they're doing it in some cooperative sense, I suspect it's more the latter, that it's in their individual interest to do it, and that's why they do it. I suspect, you know, they don't have any empathy and soulmates among rabbits, I suspect. It's not like Watership Down, I don't think. I think they're a tad more sort of self-serving than that, I suspect. But it's very difficult to prove. All we can say is we would reckon that it's probably better for rabbits in general. Why are they in groups? Which I guess is one of the questions we would want to ask. And it seems that a female rabbit in a group where there's only a single male and not many other females tends to actually have a higher reproductive rate than if she's in a larger group. Which would then ask, well, why are they doing this then? You could produce evidence to suggest that females' reproduction is compromised, an individual's female's reproduction is compromised to some extent by living in a group, but yet they do it. And the usual evolutionist sort of escape is, well, there must be some other benefit then. And the benefit's probably to do with protection, anti-predator strategies, etc., I suspect.
In such a loose-living society, do members of the same family ever interbreed? They don't, according to Dr. Diana Bell of the University of East Anglia, a world authority on rabbits.
The dominant male will try to guard the females. We've found that if there are unrelated males in the group, the male won't breed with his own daughters, so there's a kind of incest avoidance system, and he will let the younger males, unrelated males, mate with those females.
How does he detect that a female is his own daughter? How does he know?
I think it's smell, because they're an olfactory-based animal. You know, their whole life revolves around smell rather than hearing.
So the females, then, they have their kittens. Do they have a special maternity unit where they have their kittens, or do the aunties help out? Does an auntie breastfeed her nieces and nephews, or is there anything like that going on?
There doesn't seem to be that we know of. The gestation period is about 30 days, and they then suckle their young for about 21 days. So the young that you see coming up above ground about this time of year are about 21 days of age. The female will have got pregnant as soon as she gave birth to the last litter. So as soon as she comes up, having given birth, she's mated again by one of the males. And so she can be pregnant and suckling the last litter. So it turns into a bit of production line in terms of baby rabbits.
So the act of copulation triggers ovulation in her. So there's no respite at all from this kind of thing.
No, because if you imagine that they evolved in that Iberian Peninsula where there's high predation, harsh weather conditions in terms of really hot, dry summers, then they need to be a production line. When conditions are appropriate, which means in Spain, rain and, you know, lack of predators, then they'll be breeding.
Now, one slight difficulty occurs to me. Rabbits, females, feed their young once, roughly, each evening or at one particular time of the day, and then they don't go near them for the rest of the time. Surely that's unnecessary in an animal that's under the ground. Why is it so restrictive?
It comes back to their predatory pressures in their ancestral area. If you're a mother and you've got very vulnerable young, because they are nestlings, they're born without any hair, their eyes don't open for several days, and so they won't be active for another couple of weeks. They're very vulnerable and prone to predation, and you want to protect those young. And if you kept diving in to see that they were okay, tuck them in and so on, then you're going to be attracting the attention of predators. So it's called, well, I called it absentee parentism.
From
the Easter Bunny and Bugs Bunny to the Playboy Bunny, the rabbit is everyone's favourite animal. But there's much that's puzzling about this iconic furry mammal, enough to keep scientists, vets, novelists and cartoonists in business for many years to come.
Thank you very much indeed, Richard. Thanks again to Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland. And I want to remind you that you can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney, where you can download that special 1 hour long uninterrupted broadcast of the Dawn Chorus recorded at Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve and Cove last May. We'll talk to you next week. In the meantime, visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Until then, goodbye.
Agus fi, Mooney goes wild, curl or. Like Derek Mooney.